Let's begin with a few breaths, stabilizing where we're sitting, possibly with 3 points in contact with the earth, our back supported. Lift up with the inhale. Lift from the inside out, taking in the earth's atmosphere. Exhale, falling into the earth, held by the earth, all beings alive and not alive are held by the earth, just like us. Breathe in, lifting with the buoyancy and the energy of air. Exhale, falling with the earth's gravity into the earth. Well, good evening, and it's just such a pleasure to sit together in this room. It's such a peculiar thing to do for a lot of people to come to a room and sit day after day silently together. Many of us don't know each other. Coming together as total strangers who are now friends, sitting, supporting each other, sharing this practice. I have to say it's a privilege to be here. It's a privilege to me, and it's really an honor for me to speak to you this way. It came to my attention earlier today that you might not know who I am. So I'll tell you, I'll introduce myself. I'm Kathy Fisher. I'm married to Norman Fisher. This next year, in 2026, we will be celebrating our 50th wedding anniversary. So I know Norman pretty well. Not well enough yet. And we have twin sons who are 48 years old, who live in Brooklyn. We have 3 grandchildren, our own grandchildren, and 2 step-grandchildren, so 5 altogether, ages 11 to 16. Norman and I first started sitting Zazen at the Berkeley Zendo in 1971. I was a student at UC Berkeley at that time. I was 19. And I ended up studying and majoring in Buddhist studies at UC Berkeley and studying Chinese and Sanskrit as well. So my life has been kind of simple. I've only been doing Zen Buddhism. I haven't looked around. I haven't experimented with other traditions much. So I'm kind of a simple girl. Norman and I took our twin sons to Tassajara in 1977. We had been there in 1976 when I was pregnant. We got there, and it was so treacherous going over the road that we thought we better not go to the doctor again. So, after 3 months at Tassajara, we visited the doctor, told the doctor our little girl, our little baby girl, was due in 2 months, and he looked at us and said, "No, you have twins, and they could come any day." We took them back to Tassajara when they were 7 months old, lived there until they were four, and then moved to Green Gulch Farm. And they left Green Gulch Farm to go to college. That year, Norman and I were bereft because when you have twins, everybody leaves at the same time. We came to Mardejade, as we had been coming for, at that time, several years. And we said to Laura, "We're so sad because our children are leaving home." And she said, "I have an idea. My daughter needs a good school. She could come and live with you." So I was teaching fifth grade in Mill Valley at that time. And Angelica was in fifth grade, going into fifth grade. So she came to live with us at Green Gulch Farm. And she was in my fifth grade class. So this was a tremendous joy for us. First of all, we had a child in our home. Second of all, it was a daughter. We left Green Gulch and moved to, maybe half a mile away to Muir Beach, where we have lived pretty much ever since. And living at Green Gulch, after about 10 years, I became a school teacher in Mill Valley. I'm still living at Green Gulch for a while. But all the while, actually for me since 1989, we'd been coming to Mardejade. My first visit was in 1989, when this place was very, very, very undeveloped, shall we say. The village, Chakala, had a few houses that were dirt floor, pigs and chickens running in and out of the house. Most people slept in hammocks outside. It was for a young hippie like myself, it was a perfect place on earth. But of course, hidden in that perfection were all the problems of poverty. There were the water, all kinds of illnesses. Laura, when I was here in 1989, spent a lot of nights up taking care of people who had had scorpion stings in town. The scorpions here are dangerous. They're not the most dangerous scorpions in Mexico, but medical attention is recommended. So this place was rough in a lot of ways. And Norman and I kept coming back and back in the summertime when it's crazy weather. And at some point, Laura and Norman decided to have Sesshin here. And Norman has been doing that ever since. And I joined him when I retired 9 years ago. So that's an introduction to me. I also just want to say, kind of an announcement. I taught science to middle school kids for 18 of the 28 years that I taught. And my specialty was oceanography and marine biology, because I'm a diver. And so I was very embarrassed yesterday when Norman and I walked out on the beach and we saw the little pretty little round purple things in the sand, and we thought, "Oh, how lovely." And then we saw these little bubbly things, kind of like clear plastic eggplants with hats or combs or something like that on the beach. And I thought, oh, I better pick them up and put them back in the water. And we were walking along, and I realized that my finger hurt quite a bit. And then we walked along some more and thought, let's go in the water. So we did. We went swimming. And I came out, and I had welts on my eyelids and across my cheek. We came home and looked it up, and lo and behold, they were Portuguese man-o-war. So when you see them out there, don't pick them up and put them back in the water. Leave them alone. And my guess is that it was this little larval stage that was in the water that stung me, because we didn't see them in the water, and you know, they float in the water. So be careful, unlike me, and be informed, unlike me. So anyway, I wanted to tell you those things. Tonight, the other thing about me is that, as I told you the first day, I am not Jewish, and this is my first Jewish retreat that I've ever participated in. It's a joy, but I find myself kind of embarrassed, like, what on earth am I doing teaching at a Jewish retreat? And then I say, well, I trust Jeff and Joanna. That's it. I just trust them, and here I am. So I'm going to talk about, I'm going to primarily reference the tradition that I'm familiar with, which is Soto Zen Buddhism. And I'll try to make it as clear as I can. Soto Zen Buddhism is not famous for being clear. So we'll do our best. We have a wonderful, actually, founder of Soto Zen Buddhism from Japan, 13th century Japan, by the name of Dogen. And he was a brilliant writer, a beautiful writer and poet, and made a very important contribution to our understanding and practice of Zen in our time. So I'm going to reference a couple of passages of Dogen's. First of all, just the title of one of them, called the Genjo Koan, which is translated variously, but including actualizing the fundamental point. Actualizing the fundamental point, that covers a lot of territory, doesn't it? So, but first I want to think about the word actualizing. To me, it's about making or bringing or allowing or opening. Words are a challenge. The purpose of a word is to define a boundary. If I say the word red and you think red, you probably won't think of blue or yellow, because blue and yellow don't really include red. Red is red. If I give you directions to my house, I will tell you the street names, when to turn right and when to turn left. If you ignore or forget those instructions, you might get lost, because I am defining a boundary. Our language is important to us in this way. Yet we also use language to convey things with soft boundaries, changeable boundaries. So when conveying a feeling or a thought having to do with feelings, insights, hopes, and aspirations, our language turns kind of experimental. For example, in older books about Zen, one might see the phrase, achieve enlightenment. This is how you can achieve enlightenment, or something like that. over the years, people have looked at that language and thought, let's try again. Let's experiment with language that conveys this practice. How about opening to enlightenment? Allowing enlightenment to achieve me? Or, how about skipping both achieve and enlightenment and just say the way? Or how things really are? Or the heart's desire? Actualizing is one of those experimental words, and I think a particularly interesting word. But still, words are boundaries. Dogen says in his writing, Actualizing the Fundamental Point, he says, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. The phrase, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away, at first sounds like everybody goes poof and disappears when you actualize the myriad things. But I think the operative word in this sentence is your and of others. Our sense of mine, this is mine and that's yours, is what drops away. And the language of the next sentence, no trace of realization remains, and that no trace continues endlessly, because the boundary has dissolved, and we see there never was a boundary. In our usual way of thinking, it seems to say that we tend to hold realization as a possession. Mine or yours, or maybe somebody over there has it. That sense of realization as something we want and don't yet have is not that different from all of our possessions. My car and the car I want, my clothes and my plan to go shopping for more, my family, and so on. Well, we know that my car and my clothes are kind of like possessions in that we see them and we want them and we buy them. We use them, we take care of them, and hopefully later on dispose of them responsibly. We also know how problematic it is to think of our families in that way. And really, thinking of practice in that way makes no sense at all. Saying yours or mine's, my or anyone else's realization is problematic. It is absurd. Dogen brings up this point in many times in his writings. No trace of the possession, yours and mine, my body, my realization. No sense of my. This is also what no eyes, no ears, etc. means in the Heart Sutra, if you know that sutra. And this is what emptiness means in our Zen heritage. Empty is a problematic word in English. But we're kind of stuck with a lot of problematic words. So we understand these words as indicators, like codes, not truths unto themselves. To understand these old Buddhist texts, it's best not to bear down too hard on the words in English, rather to use the words as indicators, like street signs. And I know this is very different in Jewish study. In our Buddhist study, we are looking at texts that date back thousands of years, that have been translated through many languages over and over again by many people. And so the language that comes to us, you know, it's a gift, but it's sometimes we can't bear down on it too much. And that's especially clear with the word emptiness. As we know, emptiness in English is kind of a sad word. If I say, oh, I understand emptiness, you might want to give me a hug or something, you know. So it doesn't convey the sense that we get from the practice itself. But we use the word. So the words we use are like street signs. The sign is not the street. Yet it is very helpful when we want to find the street. That's why it's best not to bear down on words like emptiness as the best container for Buddhist teaching. We generate our own language from this practice, or from our own human experience. So we give a wide berth to words like emptiness, which point to human experience yet don't quite touch it. Human experience is dynamic. It is changing. It is emerging. It cannot be pinned down. And that is the meaning of emptiness, of no self. It is dynamic. It is changing. It is emerging. And it cannot be pinned down. Do you know about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle? Some are nodding. It's a principle in physics. In layperson's terms, it says the velocity and the location or position of a particle cannot be measured at the same time. You can measure the location, the position of the particle, but if you think that fully describes a particle, you're missing the other thing the particle does, which is moves really fast. I like this example because it means that the observer controls what is observed. You know, if I want to learn about, say, an animal, I can kill it, cut it open, and examine its parts. I can learn a lot that way. But if I really want to learn about the animal, I want to figure out how to observe it in its own home, its own environment, its own dynamic, changing, emerging environment and life where it cannot be pinned down. So words are just pointers, like road signs. Words and language can also contain us without our noticing. Like living in a beautiful house, a house made of language, not noticing the outdoors. When we catch a glimpse of that something is missing, we don't burn down the house. We simply walk through the doorway to the outside. We don't need to build a doorway. It's already built. In fact, the door is probably already open. We just keep walking in our house past the door without noticing that it's open. What I mean by walking out of the house is giving language a break. Learning how to give language a break in our meditation practice. Observe how thoughts arise and almost immediately form language. Then allow that language to fall away. It needs a break. Language is an expression of thought, and thought is the activity of mind. Mind in Buddhism is one of the six senses. We read this in the Heart Sutra. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Our meditation practice does not exclude mind, but mind tends to exclude the other senses, at least in our culture and times. So we turn our attention, we teach ourselves and learn how to turn our attention to the other senses. In Zazen practice, we return and return and return our attention to body, to breath. We don't try to control breath, just allow breath, its rising and falling. After Zazen, and in and out of our whole day, we can put our attention on the bottom of our feet. As we walk around, we can feel each step as the bottom of our foot touches the earth. We can do this when we go home, when you walk out your front door toward your car, instead of thinking of all the things that you have to do in the day, put your attention at the bottom of your feet and feel your foot, one after the other, in contact with the earth. We can turn our attention to sound, ocean sound, distant music, when we go home, traffic sound, machinery, wind, birds, human voices, insects. We are surrounded by sound and can enter the field of sound anytime. The field of sound is interesting because it's very similar to thought. The field of sound, there's repetitive, rhythmic sound, there's punctuated sound, there's startling sound, even scary sound, there's soothing sound, and some of the sound we hear is predictable, some is surprising. It's very similar to how our mind works, how thoughts work. Without doing anything in particular, like sharpening our senses or something, we just spend time each day with each sense. In Dogen's words, that myriad things come forth and experience themselves is awakening. These myriad things come forth through all our senses. Dogen often makes the point that awakening is not necessarily fancy, let alone psychedelic. It's just that the whole world opens up to us when we live in all of our senses, not just mind, not just thought. I'm going to have to say something about eyes because I love to think about light. You know, our eyes see light. That's all they see. Our eyes do not see objects. We just see light. And if you have any doubt about that, go in a dark closet and turn off the lights. See what you see. Our eyes see light. Our eyes see 7 colors of light, electromagnetic radiation from the sun, only 7 colors. And you probably all learned Roy G. Biv when you were in school. Those are the 7 colors: red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. Those are the only colors we see. All the other colors that we think we see are created in our mind. They're an averaging of those colors, including white. There is no white light. There is no wavelength that corresponds to white. All the colors together make white. And you can, if I would have thought of this before I came, I would have brought you a little present. There's a diffraction grating thing that you can get. Maybe you've seen the glasses, and you can look through it. It's got a lot of little scratches in it, so it basically sorts the light out into its colors, which is what a prism does. And you look around, and you can see the rainbows in everything. Like you can go to a green plant and look at the leaf and see it's not pure green, it's a mix of yellow and maybe a little orange. So what our brain, I mean, if we think we can stop our brain from, you know, making generalizations about things that we shouldn't, well, our brain works this way. Our brain is the ultimate storyteller. It tells us the story of mauve and beige. It's a story. There is no mauve, there is no beige. All of our favorite colors that we would order from the mail order catalog, none of them are real colors. That is really existing as corresponding to wavelengths of light that come from the sun. I had to throw that in. So, I had to throw in the part about light because I love to think about that, to think about how our eyes just see light and our brain does the rest. And our language does the rest. So there's another fascicle or another piece of writing of Dogen's that I wanted to bring up. It's called Only a Buddha and a Buddha. It means we perceive Buddha only with our own Buddha eye. There is no Buddha without our own Buddha eye perceiving it. It is not an object, this Buddha. And you can use any word you want. If you're not comfortable with Buddha or Buddhist words, you can use any word you want. Only a Buddha and a Buddha. Only a Buddha can see another Buddha because of the Buddha eye. And that is why the Bodhisattva is the one. These are, not real people, but Buddha was a real person, but Bodhisattvas are not real people, but the Bodhisattva ideal is the one who is completely open to the true nature of the world, but refuses to go to nirvana, leave and go to nirvana, and until everyone can come along, absolutely everyone on this earth and in this world system. So, the Bodhisattva, the way the Bodhisattva does this, the Bodhisattva has tremendous energy and inspiration to save all beings. We call it save all beings. Save is another one of those iffy words, but never mind, we'll go with it for now. The Bodhisattva has the energy and inspiration to save all beings until all beings can enter together to nirvana. That's the language. And why? because they see each and every being as Buddha. They are saving all Buddhas. They cannot abandon a Buddha, a suffering Buddha, a starving, injured, suffering Buddha to go to Nirvana. That would be odd. This is the foundation of ethical conduct in Buddhism. We don't give up on anyone. Period. We don't give up on anyone. Because we see them with our Buddha eye. And if we don't, we step back and take a break because we're probably exhausted. Dogen writes, this is from a different writing, and I think that it's one of my favorite passages that I'd like to share with you. He writes, to study the way with the body means to study the way with your own body. It is the study of the way using this lump of red flesh. The body comes forth from the study of the way. Everything comes forth from the study of the way. Everything which comes forth from the study of the way is the true human body. To study the way with the body means to study the way with your own body. It is the study of the way using this lump of red flesh. The body comes forth from the study of the way. Everything which comes forth from the study of the way is the true human body. So there is a word I'll go back to emptiness. The word for emptiness in Sanskrit is shunyata. And shunyata was especially studied and articulated by a second century Indian brilliant logician and Buddhist ancestor. His name was Nagarjuna. And the study of emptiness was summed up by Nagarjuna with the term middle way. Perhaps you've heard of the middle way, which does not mean halfway between here or there, and it does not mean a compromise between this and that. It means no place to hold on to. It means no static, permanent state anywhere. Everything is dynamic. In China, the phrase came through the koans, not knowing is nearest. That was the Chinese expression of the middle way. Not knowing is nearest. It captures the Chinese, captures that sense of the middle way as no place to hold on to, no static, permanent state anywhere. By the way, can you all hear me?
Yeah.
The sound is good? Okay. in Suzuki Roshi's words, beginner's mind. That is Suzuki Roshi's expression of the middle way. If you know anything about that phrase, beginner's mind. In the mind of the beginner, there are many possibilities. In the mind of the expert, there are few. So that sense of open, wide open, and dynamic. So there is Stephen Batchelor. Did somebody mention Stephen Batchelor? I can't remember. I thought they did. He wrote a wonderful book on this work, the middle way work. And he used the word contingency for emptiness, which is interesting. So he picked a word that means, you know, expresses how things are in relation to everything else all the time. Everything is in a relationship of contingency. I think that's pretty good. I like the word resonance. Resonance. I like it because as an expression of emptiness, or, you know, that shunyata. I like it because it references a common experience, not a special occasion experience. It is specific and it's immediate. And the word resonance gives us access to what we're talking about, for me, more than something like emptiness does, or even enlightenment. It means something specific in physics. The reinforcement or prolongation of sound by reflection from a surface or by the synchronous vibration. I lost my page. I'll start over with that sentence. Resonance means the reinforcement or prolongation of sound by reflection, bouncing off from a surface, or by the synchronous vibration of a neighboring object. And resonance means something common, experiential to us. When I feel or experience resonance, I don't disappear and go poof in an enlightened cloud of nothingness or something like that. No, I'm here. And while I'm here, I feel a kind of shimmering connection with something that is not me, really. I might feel resonance when I hear a bird song, the wind or the rain, even when a truck drives by. When we hear music, we perceive resonance with our whole bodies, not just our ears. That's why we want to get up and dance. Going on a little bit, I wanted to talk about, I may go back to resonance, I will go back to resonance, but there is a beautiful Japanese scroll, a painting. It's a picture of a monkey in a tree, and the monkey, it's in the evening, and the reflection of the moon is on a water. There's a stream next to the monkey. The reflection of the moon is in the stream. And the monkey wants the moon in the water, and the monkey feels the resonance of the moon as we do when we see the moon. She feels the resonance of the moon and the water in her body, and at the same time, she believes it's an object that she could grab and have for herself. She's reaching out for the reflection while holding on to the tree branch. It looks precarious. Her misconception could be dangerous if she fell out of the tree and into the water. We don't know if she can swim. We don't know if there's alligators. So here we are, feeling resonance with something beautiful or someone special, or with water, because we are mostly water, or with our religious practice. Our inclination is to reach out for it as though it were an object we could grab and hold for ourselves. But as the painting of the monkey reaching for the moon in the water indicates, the act of grabbing, even if the monkey could actually get the reflection, would obliterate the thing she thinks she can grab. The image is beautiful, and it's sad, and it's funny, of feeling drawn to, or love for, or resonant with something, alongside the folly of thinking of that resonance as an object that we could somehow acquire for ourselves. Our practice is sitting quietly with the resonance or the dissonance as it comes and goes. When a cloud blocks the moonlight, there is no moon on the water. When the cloud blows away, the moon comes back. The moon never left. We don't control the moon or the cloud, and therefore not the resonance either. This resonance is mind itself is Buddha. Or however you express a sense of I really invite you to put this image into your own language. Mind as it is, as it always is, what separates us from seeing the beauty of this resonance is that, like the monkey, we tend to think of Buddha as separate from us, and that our practice is to find Buddha and then line up behind him or her. And something about our thought of future as an abstraction, a projection of our experience of resonance in the present, our experience of awe, our experience of longing. We long for peace. We long for the end of suffering in our world today. Our hearts ache with this longing. This is our resonance with the suffering of the so-called others. I'm wondering, is that where we generate a concept of hope for the future, projecting our heartache as our vision of the future? The future is where we find the promise that things will get better, because we long for relief from suffering in the present. Maybe our practice this week is sitting with the longing, the awe, the resonance with suffering in the present, refraining from abstraction, refraining from abstracting that longing as a scenario of the future. Dogen says in the Genjo Koan, when Dharma does not fill, Dharma is, understanding. When Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, you think it is already sufficient. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing. This is such a beautiful expression to me of this sense of longing, this sense of awe that we share.
Can you read that one more time?
Yeah.
Loudly?
Oh, can I turn up the volume? I can't. Am I kind of getting softer?
That's
here?
What you are.
Okay.
That's all that.
Okay. When Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, you think it is already sufficient. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing.
Can you read the definition of Dharma again?
Dharma is, let's call it for this sentence, understanding, your deep understanding. When Dharma fills your whole body and mind, when Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, you think it's sufficient. You think you got it. Oh, I got that. When Dharma does fill your body and mind, you understand that something is missing. This grief, heartache, longing, awe, and resonance is human life in the present moment. Skip ahead because I'm running out of time. So there's another phrase of Dogen's, unconstructedness in stillness. Unconstructedness in stillness. He says, it is immediate realization. Unconstructedness in stillness. Unconstructedness is a translation of the Sanskrit word asankṛta, meaning unconditioned dharmas, or that which is unconditioned. It's three characteristics from this is way old, first or second century Indian Buddhist teaching. Its three characteristics are not attached to thoughts, free from all desires, and without calculation. So, taking a look at these three characteristics of unconstructedness, we might notice that it does not say without thoughts and without desires, as one of our beloved ancestors says, those who are without thoughts and desires are dead. This is about attachment to thoughts, which means misunderstanding what thoughts are. That is, thoughts are thoughts. Like bird song is bird song. They are not truths or messages from somewhere or directives in any way. The second is engaging desires. That is, thinking that desires are to be acted on. The third characteristic of this unconstructedness is without calculation. That's interesting. What we know is that we calculate in situations in which we want to gain advantage. Even if we want to gain advantage on behalf of others, not only ourselves, we're kind of saying, I'm going to make myself the authority here with regard to what would be best. I'm going to take control. I'm going to game this thing to give advantage to my team. That sort of thing. And it involves anticipating the future to calculate a strategy. We would do this when we don't trust reality as it is, as it unfolds, as it opens to us. And we don't trust ourselves either. I lost my page. When you lose your page, it means the talk is over. What I wanted to say about this, which I seem to have lost my page, is that this strategizing in the future this way, this, you know, I'm going to do this in order to get that and so on, that is not characteristic of religious practice. It's characteristic of capitalism. We create a future. We have hopes in the future. We have plans for the future. And we believe that that future is coming. We structure the future. And we operate that way. I'm not commenting on the problem of capitalism or anything like that. What I'm saying is that our spiritual practice does not go there. In our spiritual practice, we're in the present. We're in this completely encompassed moment of time together. This moment, this body, this mind, that's where our practice is. And when we project future, I'll get enlightened in the future, or something like that, we are stepping into a whole other realm of being. So we need, you know, we learn to step back. We learn how to simply step back. Come on back to this breath, this foot on the floor, this body, this color, this moment, this bird sound. That is our, I think, that is my religious practice. And of course we have the capacity to handle the future and do all kinds of things, but coming back home to this practice, this moment, this place, with these people, that is my practice. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.